Hey guys, it's Albert. We are into the slow part of the NFL calendar, but there will be nothing slow about this podcast. We've got takeaways on the schedule. We've got takeaways on the Cowboys. We got takeaways on the New York Jets' new running back. We also have a special guest this week to help us recap the 2020 draft and even look ahead a little bit to 2021. And as always, we wrap things up with all of your questions in the six-pack. Let's go. All right, welcome in. It's the MMQB podcast with Albert Breer. We're a week past the draft now. We're into this period where there's not going to be a whole lot going on. I mean, now till the end of training camp, no traditional OTAs, probably no full squad mini camps. The next time we'll see football players all together as a team, if we're lucky, it'll probably be the end of July for training camp. But we've got plenty of content always to get to you guys, and we're going to try to get creative over the next couple of months to do that. Great show for you coming this week. We got a guest coming in just to recap this year's draft, good friend of mine who knows the class inside and out, and then we're going to look ahead a little bit to 2021 as well. As always, we're going to get to your questions in the mailbag, but we start with the takeaways like we always do. And you know, my first takeaway: the schedule release is going to look fairly normal, I think, on Thursday, outside of the fact that it's not going to be in a studio. It's going to be done remotely the way that the draft was done. So it's going to look a little different. I think it'll be presented in much the same way, presented as if we're going to have a normal schedule. But, you know, I think that you will be able to see at least traces of the contingency plans the NFL has been working on in how the schedule is presented. Now, whether or not they're open about that, we'll see. But I do think there will be elements to the schedule that will be telltale. I can't tell you what those elements are going to be. What I can tell you is what teams are on the lookout for. Number one, they're on the lookout for sort of these collapsible pieces to the schedule. Now, it could be like week 2 to 5. It could be week 4 to 7. Most teams don't expect it to come in week 1. They do expect a normal week 1 schedule that in some way will celebrate, you know, a return to normalcy with a return of football. So, but you should be able to potentially see where the league collapsed schedule. Well, how would they do that? Probably by putting and clustering interconference games together. So you can pull those right out. And maybe if you had to go to 14 or 12 games, it would look a little like baseball used to look like, where the American League and the National League wouldn't play against each other till the World Series. Number two, the new stadiums in Vegas and Los Angeles, it wouldn't be surprising if they give those teams, the Rams, the Raiders, the Chargers, a little more runway before opening those stadiums. So, you know, maybe in the case of the LA teams, they'd hope to have a week 1 opening. Maybe that's in week 2 or week 3. It'd be a little more difficult with two teams in the stadium logistically to push it too far back. Maybe the Raiders don't play in Vegas until week 3. The Vegas stadium's a little behind the LA stadium in construction. So that'd be another thing to look at. And then three, you know, how do the New York and LA teams and the teams that are in areas that were a little bit more affected or under stricter restrictions, how are their schedules set up? So are the Jets and Giants backloaded with home games? Are the Patriots backloaded with home games? Are the LA teams backloaded with home games? Do we look in week 16 and we see the Rams playing on a Thursday and the Chargers playing on a Monday in SoFi Stadium? Same thing. In week 15, do we see the Jets playing on a Sunday and the Giants playing on a Monday at MetLife Stadium? I think those would be other things to watch. So it'll be interesting just to see when we're able to kind of sit and break this thing down, whether or not there are elements to the schedule that are directly related to what the contingency plans have been discussed, the contingency plans discussed over the last few weeks internally by the NFL. Takeaway number two, it's sort of going to be a mea culpa. I thought it was unlikely the Super Bowl get moved. After talking to people over the last week, I don't think it's that unlikely. I still think the chances are they play a 16-game schedule on time with fans in the stands and all of that. I think there's still a good chance of that. But after talking to some people about a couple of things that could be in play here, I kind of get the idea the Super Bowl could be moved. And there are a couple of reasons why. First, and I didn't know this, but one of the reasons I thought that the NFL wouldn't move the Super Bowl is because the amount of convention space it takes, because the amount of hotel rooms it requires. What I didn't know is when each Super Bowl city bids, part of the bidding process is that you've got to build in dates that the league, you got build-in dates that are cleared so the league can move the Super Bowl if it has to. I don't know what those dates are for Tampa, but as part of the bidding process, they would have been required to block off dates other than just February 7th for the game. And so it wouldn't be maybe as hard to move it as I had initially thought. Second, and I think this is just as important, if not more important, I think they would rather play a full 16-game schedule starting October 1st or November 1st rather than a full schedule starting October 1st or November 1st with fans rather than any part of the schedule without fans. And the reason why is simple. It's money. The estimates I got from having talked to some team presidents over the weekend, it cost teams about $100 million a piece on average, some more, some less, but on average about $100 million a piece in local revenue if they played the whole season without fans. That would mean, I mean, obviously a big financial hit for the owners. It would also mean that the players would feel it and that would affect the salary cap the next year. And, you know, say it's a $100 million loss, right? Well, if it's a $100 million loss per team, that's $48 million off the salary cap. And that's significant. That's going to affect how teams look at individual players, how they plan to extend this player or that player. And I don't think that they would take the hit all at once. I think the league would negotiate with the union to smooth the cap out. The problem with that is for players is then you'd be borrowing from future years. So you might not experience the spike when the new TV deals go in a couple of years. And so, I think to avoid those sorts of things, I think it would be valuable for the teams. It'd be valuable for the players. It'd be valuable for the television networks to be able to present the real NFL product. So I don't think it's – I'll just put it this way. I think it's more likely than I thought it was a couple weeks ago that the start of the season could be moved and a full 16-game schedule could start, say, October 1st or November 1st if they think it's going to make a difference as far as having fans in the stands. Takeaway number three, Don Shula, one of the great figures in NFL history, passed away this week. I didn't have the personal interaction with him. Some other people did. I can just tell you the people in the Dolphin organization revered him, and that's not fake. It's real. And, he was really, I think very few people in the history of the NFL have achieved the sort of iconic status that Shula achieved. And I think there are a few things that really stick out to me. Number one, what he did sort of crossed generations. And, you know, I think about the fact that, he won with the Baltimore Colts, was sort of like, was on like a track to be like in a Hall of Fame level coach during his 7 years with the Colts. And that's just the Colts, right? Most people don't, there are a lot of people out there probably don't know he coached for the Colts. Then he goes to the Dolphins in 1970. They have the two Super Bowl teams. Three actually made it there, two won it. One of those teams is the undefeated team, which goes down in NFL history as one of the all-time greats. Then he comes back and he wins with Marino in the 80s and 90s when I was growing up. And even in between, right? Like even in between, like I believe 2 years before Dan Marino got to Miami, maybe it was a year before Marino got to Miami, he went to a Super Bowl with David Woodley. And so it's just this consistent success, being able to win with different guys over and over and over again. And I don't know why this popped into my head, why I did the math the other day, but when I looked at the totality of what he had accomplished, I saw that my dad was 14 when Don Shula took the job in Baltimore, and I was 15 when he retired from the Dolphins. So you want to talk about spanning generations. In fact, I might have been 16. I think I was actually 16. You want to talk about spanning generations and being able to kind of link one generation to the next. That's Don Shula. The other part of his impact that I think is undeniable, the impact in the state of Florida. When he went there, I'm not sure what it was like, but I would venture to say football wasn't in the position that it is now there, where it's the number one sport. And like if you look right now, and I looked this up the other day, among the top 100 recruits in the class of 2020, In high school football, 17 are from the state of Florida. That's a staggering number. It's become a hotbed for talent, and we've seen what's happened to the pro game there. They've expanded twice more. The NFL has expanded twice more in that state, the Buccaneers in 76 and the Jaguars in 95. And the college programs have, at times, and almost alternating times, been among the best in the country. Florida State, Florida, Miami. And you even have some of the other programs, UCF, USF, that have sort of burst onto the scene as well. And so, I mean, Florida's become a capital of football. A capital for football. And, you know, when Don Shula got there in 1970, I'm not sure it was that way. So RIP Don Shula, one of the great figures, not just in the history of the NFL, in the history of all of sports. Takeaway number four, Frank Gore, positively amazing. For him to be still playing, and good for him, winding up, deciding to come out and play a 16th NFL season. It's at that position, like, almost incomprehensible. And I do think that there's a couple things to watch here. You know, first, I think you have to kind of keep an eye on what Adam Gase's intent is here. And I remember 2 years ago when they brought him to the Dolphins, the part of the importance of bringing him in there was a culture thing. And Adam Gase, coming out of the 2017 season, really felt like they needed to hit the reset button in that regard. The Dolphins did. And so they brought in Danny Amendola. They brought in Frank Gore. They brought in Robert Quinn. They brought in a lot of, like, high character guys. And, you know, Gase really thought there was value in that. Now, ultimately, the season went the wrong way, but he really felt like at the end of the year, that team was still playing hard despite all the circumstances. So many things, you know, kind of went sideways and everything else the year before. Even when that team had its issues in 2018, he was able to sort of kind of keep that train on the tracks. And Frank Gore is a big part of that. So I think that's a piece of it. And then, of course, what does this mean for Le'Veon Bell? We know that, like, how up and down Le'Veon Bell's, whatever it is now, 14 months with the Jets have been. What does this mean for how Le'Veon Bell's used? What does this mean for Le'Veon Bell's future there? I think there are a lot of questions you can ask. Finally, takeaway number five. I know what everybody's going to do with the Andy Dalton situation and sort of transpose it to the Dak, or I guess transpose is the wrong word, right? Like affix it to the Dak Prescott contract negotiation. I'm going to give you kind of a different look at this one. I think this is more about the Cowboys' experience with backup quarterbacks and their history with backup quarterbacks. And they've seen both sides of it. They saw it in 2015 when Tony Romo went down, and I believe they finished 4-12 because they were completely unprepared at the backup quarterback position. And so they wound up having to bring in, I mean, like, it was one thing to the next, and that was a really good team. They were coming off of, I believe, a 12-4 year that, like, they almost wound up in the NFC title game. That was the Dez Cottet situation that prevented them from getting there. But they wind up 4-12 the next year. So there they see how things can go wrong if you're not properly fortified with the backup quarterback. The year after that, Romo gets hurt again, and in comes a fourth-round pick named Dak Prescott. They find out they've struck gold. They go 13-3. So Cowboys have seen what this looks like both ways, good and bad. If you're prepared, if you're not prepared. They have a team right now that's full of players that are right in the, like, just prime of their careers or in the back end of the prime of their careers, and you can go through the players. I mean, Zach Martin, Tyron Smith, Amari Cooper, Zeke Elliott, DeMarcus Lawrence, on and on and on. Jalen Smith. You have all these players that are sort of right there in the wheelhouse of their prime, and that puts the team in a championship window. And so what happens if you lose your starter for 5 or 6 weeks? You need somebody who's going to protect the team's ability to contend, protect the team's seeding. That's what Teddy Bridgewater did for the New Orleans Saints last year. And so I think that's why Andy Dalton's there. That said, it does give the team a little leverage in that they can say, okay, Dak, you don't want to show up for training camp? Fine. You know, we're going to be okay implementing Mike McCarthy's offense, getting ourselves ready to go without you here. And so it does give the team a little bit of leverage from that standpoint. But that said, I think this is more about the team's history with backup quarterbacks, and in particular, the way it went the right way in 2016 and the wrong way in 2015. All right, so those are my takeaways, and we're going to get to our special guest right after this. Now we're going to bring in a recurring guest to the podcast, good friend of mine, a colleague of mine for a bunch of years at NFL Network, and one of the absolute premier draft guys in the business, Daniel Jeremiah. Welcome back. I guess I'd start here, bud. Like, what's this week like for you? I mean, I'd imagine it'd be like the draft, like maybe day three is the last day of school, and now it feels a little like summer vacation.
Yeah, I was able to retire the razor. Which was a good feeling. Put that thing to the side. I've logged a bunch of jump shots in the driveway. I've got some quality pool time, and then in between that, still catching up with buddies around the league and kind of seeing what's going on. But it's been nice. Yeah, I like to catch my breath a little bit after that thing's over, man. It's my favorite event of the year. It's obviously the key part of my job. But once it gets done, it's kind of like taking that final tour, man. It's a good feeling.
Okay, so let's start here. I want to just kind of get your general impressions from how the draft went. I know a lot of people, you know, it struck me because like a lot of people had said like, okay, like everybody's going to be wrong this year because there isn't as much, you know, there isn't as much gossip out there. Guys aren't trading gossip at pro days. There's not as much interaction between teams and, you know, you don't have all the scouts coming in house for the draft meetings where a lot of the chatter happens. Do you think there's a reason why it wasn't that way? You know, like it felt like it was pretty chalk, you know, like, yeah. And not that there weren't some curveballs there. Maybe, you know, people didn't have Andrew Thomas going fourth to the Giants. They might have had a Tristan Wirfs or someone there, but it seemed like the surprises that we saw were relatively minor. So have you kind of gone through that in your head? Why? I mean, in a year where maybe you'd think there'd be a lot of volatility, it was really chalk at the top.
Well, I think because of the limited interaction and the limited information that you had this year, that you saw maybe a little more conservative approach, you know, where you didn't have as many guys that were kind of late climbers, you know, those kind of late risers, whatever you want to call them. That didn't really happen this year. Even, you know, like Jordan Brooks was somebody that we had been talking about for a few weeks as somebody that, look, he's ultra athletic. There's a chance he could sneak into round one. There wasn't really... even Igbinoghene from Auburn, you knew that some teams really, really liked him. There wasn't that one pick where you're just like, where did that come from? I think a lot of it was just teams being a little bit more cautious and a little bit more concerned.
Okay, so if there was one thing that did catch you by surprise on the first night, what would it have been then?
Well, I think a lot of people were saying Green Bay with Jordan Love. We had talked that between us. I'd put it in a couple mock drafts throughout the process, so that didn't really surprise me all that much. To be honest with you, like one of the more surprising moves, is because nobody could anticipate it, was the Chargers coming back in to get Kenneth Murray later on in the draft after taking Herbert. I think the thing that made this draft fun for me was that at 5 and 6, the Miami Dolphins, you know, hat tip to them, because we couldn't get a feel, you know, was the there's some support for Herbert. We knew there was support for Tua, the medical, and then you find out that his doctors, you know, with the Dolphins, like all this stuff was kind of out there, and they ended up right where we began. But that one was what made it kind of fun, because literally, I swear, when they said the Dolphins pick is in, I didn't know if it's Herbert or if it was Tua.
So, like, take us inside that then, because I think that part of it's fascinating. Like, when you're getting close to the draft, how is that discussion happening? You know, like with the medical, obviously, is a factor. The tape is the tape. They'd spent so many resources just poured into the quarterback position. And, you know, the owner was at the LSU game. The owner was at the bowl game that he didn't even play in. Like, the team president was at the bowl game. They'd just expended so many resources on scouting the kid and all the quarterbacks. And then you have the medical that's sort of sitting out there. You have your last set of medical meetings. I know you don't know exactly how Miami's maybe went at the end, but like, how does that discussion happen at the very end where they're signing off on Tua and they're deciding, okay, we're comfortable, we're doing this.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's kind of a two-part process. You put the list together based off where you're comfortable, and that's with your personnel department, obviously your head coach and your owner are involved in that process. But just as a player, stack them. And then you have them stacked. And then I would imagine, you know, the last piece of medical information they could have where it was just the doctors giving you kind of a thumbs up or a thumbs down on this one. I think that really happened in early April, you know, when they were comfortable with the medical at that point in time. Obviously, did a nice job of not letting that out of where they stood on the medical. Because I think if they had told us or any of us out there in the media that they were comfortable with Tua medically, if that had been uttered, we would have all said, they're taking Tua. You know, they're not going to take Justin. That was the deciding factor for me in trying to figure out how do you guess who these guys are going to pick. And when you have that piece of information that's there's that void there, that's where you fill it and say, okay, well, if there's nothing certain there, then maybe it's Herbert. But, you know, I'm sure they had that information in hand and in-house, and they knew they were going to take Tua. I'm assuming they knew that early in April.
How much better was Tua on tape than Herbert?
Well, I thought there was a pretty good gap between them. I just think the word urgency, the word that I would use, I just think Tua just played with more urgency, obviously surrounded by tremendous talent, but just more instinctive, just more of a feel for the game. Herbert's bigger, stronger, faster. He can make some unbelievable throws, but I think that's still kind of, he's still getting more comfortable in his in his playing style, whereas I think Tua knows exactly who he is in that regard.
Knowing what you know, if you were the Dolphins, do you think you would have? If you were the GM, you think you would have felt comfortable with it? Like, you know, and I think you and I have gone over the history. Yeah. You know, like it's there's some bad history of like teams rolling the dice on quarterbacks in the first round with injury history. You know, do you think you would have felt comfortable going forward with Tua, or do you not know enough?
Yeah, I mean, not knowing. Knowing the medical side of it, you know, in terms of what your doctors are saying, and it's two things, right? Is he going to be up to speed, ready to play at the beginning of the year? Yeah, okay, that's one piece of information. But then what's the likelihood of recurrence, and how much longevity are we talking about here? And you know how GMs think, right? If you can guarantee me I'm going to get 4 or 5 great years out of this kid, but then I'm getting the next contract, and that's how a lot of these guys operate, is okay, that gets me to the next contract, and we'll deal with that problem when it arises. But if you can guarantee me we're going to get 5 years of high level play, then we're okay there. It's just hard to sit on the outside without having that detailed medical information. I know if I'm going to take a little bit of a risk on a player, I'm going to take it on a kid like this who I've seen play at a ridiculously high level.
Okay, so like just from a global standpoint, when you look at the draft in general, and I don't even know, do you do draft grades?
Path of the draft, I only had to do 2 days. I did it Monday and Tuesday, so I had to do it for a couple divisions. But I don't do like the full article on draft grades. I'm not, to be perfectly honest with you, I've never been a big a draft grade fan.
Right.
But you know how it is. The numbers for those are off the chart.
Oh, I know.
People love it. So I get why it's done, but I don't really enjoy the.
Yeah, it's like internet heroin. Process. It's like like that and the mocks. Like,
yeah.
So like the reason I ask is I want to, like, I'm sure there are some teams that like you look at and you say, at least on paper, like, I think that they did well. And for me, when I go through that, it's sort of like, wow, like it seems like that guy, they got that guy at a really good spot, and they got this guy at a really good spot. That's normally the way I kind of process it. So from that standpoint, like, are there a couple teams that you thought did really well?
Yeah, I thought Baltimore and Minnesota, I thought were outstanding, just in terms of, you know, I joked with one of my buddies with the Ravens and their personnel department. I'm like, dude, how does this happen every year? You guys just sit and wait, and just great player after great player just fall into your lap and you pick them. But I mean, it was like, were they able to get Patrick Queen? Tremendous value. Were they able to get J.K. Dobbins? Tremendous value. Madubuike from A&M, value. Like, it was just all the way through. The last guy they took, the safety from Iowa, I thought was like a 4th-round player. They got him in the 7th round.
Stone,
Geno,
right?
Stone, yeah. So he's a good player. So I thought they were outstanding. And then I think with Minnesota, obviously they had a ton of picks as well. When you get Justin Jefferson, who is tailor-made for this system, like, he's going to catch a million balls in that system. So that's a huge hit. Jeff Gladney's feistiness, competitiveness, ball skills, like, he fits like kind of the Mike Zimmer type of DB. He's plug and play. And then even Ezra Cleveland. Now, I don't think Ezra Cleveland's a perfect player by any stretch, but he is very athletic. And all that stretch game, all the zone game that they want to run, and they have with Dalvin Cook, and now you have O'Neal on one side, who I think ran in the 4.8s. You've got Ezra Cleveland, who's ridiculous, and you've got Bradbury in the middle of it all, who's one of the most athletic centers. Like, they can go laterally as well as any offense in the NFL right now. So I really like what they did.
Okay, I want to go back to Baltimore because you did work there, and I said this to someone there like last week. I said, what I like about the way the Ravens draft is I feel like I could explain it to my 5-year-old. Does that make sense? Like, yeah. I feel like I remember like when I looked at like some of the moves they made last year, and it's like, okay, like, so you have Lamar Jackson. It's like, all right, like, we're going to load up on tight ends so we can run the ball. We're going to get really fast receivers. That's Hollywood Brown. Yep. So, it sort of moves defenders out of the box. It feels to me like they draft the way in a way where you could explain it to a kid, like as complicated as this whole process is, it's almost like the Ravens have a way of simplifying it. Like, A, would you agree with that? And B, like, what's behind that? If I am right in what I'm saying.
Yeah. I think the other thing that the Ravens have done that nobody talks about is the fact of them identifying a problem area on the roster and not just like, dabbling in it and maybe even using a first round pick. They attack that with multiple picks. So if you just go back through the years on some of these, right? Back when I was there, we took Ben Grubbs in the first round, came back, took Marshall Yanda in the third, like both interior guys. Obviously, Ben Grubbs is a really good player, got a bunch of money from the Saints. Marshall Yanda is a Hall of Famer. So it would have been easy to say, well, we want to get tougher on the interior. We already got Ben Grubbs. Let's move on to other needs. No, let's double down. Look at what they did with Andrews and Hurst, right? You take Hurst in the first round, come back, take Andrews. Would have been easy to say, well, you address the tight end. Well, it turns out, the second player they took at that same position ends up being a big hit. This year, they take Patrick Queen in the first round. Off the ball linebacker is an area they had to address. They come back and get your Ohio State linebacker in the third round. So that's just, they've done this year after year after year, is finding a problem and then devoting multiple resources to get it fixed.
And so there's almost a humility in that too, right? Like, in that you're saying to yourself, like, we're not 100%. No one's 100%. So we're gonna throw another resource at this.
Yeah.
Just to make
increase
sure.
Increase your odds.
Like, so we like Hayden Hurst, but we also like Andrews. So let's take both. Like, it's almost like you're admitting internally, we might not get this one right, but we have to get the position right. So let's give ourselves another chance to get it right.
I think that I had already left, I believe, at this time, but I think they took Pitta and Ed Dixon in the same draft as well and doubled up on tight end all the way back then. And so, I mean, this is a theme that they've had. They did it, I think, with wideouts there last year too. I mean, I know it was a little bit later on, but they took the big Notre Dame kid after they had taken Hollywood Brown. So they wanted to get fast. Boykin, Miles Boykin is who they took. So that's just what they've done. And again, I was advocating for them last year, saying they need to build a track team around Lamar Jackson, like just make this a track meet. And then they've done that with the big guys that they have. But then any skill position players. The way philosophically it makes sense, if you're going to run the ball as well as they do, the best rushing team in the NFL, when you throw the ball, it's not appetizers. It's the main course, man. Like, this is not 5 yards, 7 yards. This is you want to suck up to try and stop our run game, you're going to pay for it 50, 60 yards at a time. So they did that. They went and got a track team around them. So when you want to drop a safety down in there, now you got to be a little bit concerned.
Well, it was interesting, too, because, like, answers to everything. Like, I even thought about, like, so you remember the Chargers attacked them with 7 DBs in that playoff game, Lamar's rookie year. And it's like, okay, so you want to put 7 DBs in the field? We'll go sign Mark Ingram. Try tackling him with that guy that's playing linebacker now. Yeah. It's just like everything has, like I said, like very simple logic, right?
And the funny thing is a lot of people, I put in a mock draft. I had Swift going to the Ravens at the bottom of one. And people lost their minds. This is the number one run team in the league. Why would they ever take a running back that high? That makes no sense. They've got this guy, that guy, the other guy. So they run it more than anybody. So they're going to always want to be a full stable there. And if they can get even better at that position, they're going to do it. And so there they go. They take Dobbins in the second round. And you've got Ingram. It's going to lighten the load on him to keep him fresh to make his career go a little bit longer. And it's gonna delay a little bit of the start of when Dobbins gets completely the keys to the kingdom there. It's just it just makes so much sense. Like, this is what we do. This is who we are. We're going to always keep reinvesting in these positions.
You know, and it's exactly like I thought about, like, the Giants, how they used to do it with D linemen, right? And I remember talking to somebody there, and it's like, we can't afford to have our strength not be our strength anymore.
Yeah.
Like, we can't afford to be in a position.
What's your formula? Yeah.
Right, right. I do have to ask you about the Packers, because I thought, I don't know, it's interesting because I feel like we've digested this maybe a little differently than the Rodgers pick was digested in 2005, even though Rodgers is now a year older than Favre was when they drafted him. So, like, do you like the idea of what they're doing? Like, and do you like the idea of taking Jordan Love when you're taking him? The way I look at it is, one thing I do like about it is that you're not pigeonholing, like, by doing this, you aren't pigeonholing yourself in a single year to have to get one, right? Yeah. Like, and I feel like that's how, like,
take
Christian Ponder.
Yeah, take that
pressure. I feel like that's how Christian Ponder goes 12th, right? Yeah. Because you decide before, you predetermine, we're getting our quarterback now. Mm-hmm. And, like, by doing this, the Packers sort of get themselves out of that situation. But there's obviously the window with Rodgers. It's like, how much longer do you have him? Don't you want to give him help? Like, what do you think of their decision not to? What do you think of their decision to put another, like, first round pick in that room? And like, how do you see that playing out?
In my opinion, Albert, I thought there was two wrongs. I thought him was the right, because you got a chance to have a smooth position of 15 years with Favre to 15 plus years with Rodgers to hopefully 15 plus years with this. So, important position, and if you really are high on this guy's ability, which Love has tremendous ability, and you're confident you can develop him, which he needs, I'd have no problem with that. I think that was a smart decision. I really do. The two things I have a problem with: number one, now let's do some things for right now. This is, receiver draft is loaded. You know, move your way around the board wherever you have to do it. But you've got to upgrade that room for Aaron Rodgers. Like, just upgrade that room, and this is the draft to do it. And they didn't do that. So I thought that was a mistake. The second mistake I would say is, I don't think that you call Aaron Rodgers when you're on the clock and say, hey, we're getting ready to take a quarterback. Like, that's not reasonable. That's not what you do. What you do, though, is when you have a quarterback that's that established, whether it's a week before the draft or a month before the draft, you as the general manager, the head coach, have a conversation with Aaron Rodgers and say, hey, look, man, we're trying to win right now, but we also have a view of the long term here, and we're trying to make sure we make the right decisions. There's a couple quarterbacks, and who knows, we don't know that they would get to us in the draft, but there's a couple guys we really like, you know, for the long term here. And if they were to get down in our area, we would take them. Now, I'm not going to tell you who that quarterback is, or the, you know, this is a 10% chance or a 99% chance we're going to do it. But I'm just giving you a heads up. I don't want you to be blindsided if we turned in the card for a quarterback in the first round. And that's a simple conversation to have. And again, a month before the draft, a week before the draft. But then when you turn it in, he's not completely blindsided by it. I don't understand, you know, why you wouldn't have had that discussion.
Yeah, that makes sense to me, because I don't know. I mean, you saw what it looked like when it went bad with Favre and Rodgers before, too. I mean, I know Gutekunst was a Southeast area scout, but that's something like, if like you said, it feels avoidable. You know what I mean? Like, it feels like, to some degree, that you can.
Remember that the Princess Bride, the movie The Princess Bride? Remember the Dread Pirate Roberts? And they said he would, every night before I went to bed, they'd say, have a nice night, I'll most likely kill you in the morning. Wake up the next day, nothing happened, have a nice night, most likely kill you in the morning. Like, I almost think with Rodgers, like, maybe this doesn't happen for a 3-year period, but at least he knows, like, it's being discussed, it's being talked about, it's a potential, there's a possibility there that this could happen. But I think when you don't know anything, and all of a sudden, you could get blindsided by that a little bit.
Sure. Okay. Is there... And I want to talk about a couple of bigger picture things to wrap up after this. But is there a fit or two that you really liked? Like, where you said to yourself, right player, right team, that's going to work?
That's a good question. You know who I really liked? And we talked about it just a minute ago there with Kenneth Murray going to the Chargers. And think of it from this standpoint. If you are playing the Kansas City Chiefs twice a year and you have – a third down situation, you have the length and athleticism and speed of Murray and Derwin James both lined up in the middle of the field. Now, they could be stacked next to each other. They could be on top of each other. When everything can get out to the perimeter, you've got two guys that can go run and chase and use their length and speed to make plays. Like that, that to me is a great fit for your division and for who you're going to play and your opponents. And I thought inside the division, it was fascinating to see then what the Broncos and the Raiders did, which was, okay, we're going to put together a 4x1 team, and we're going to try and keep up with you guys on the scoreboard on the other side of things. So when you look at, you know, bringing in Jerry Jeudy and KJ Hamler, Denver, okay, Drew Locke, big arm, like they've got, you know, Melvin Gordon, they've got backs now to go along with Philip Lindsay. I mean, this is a team that's got a real identity now offensively. Raiders did the same thing. You know, when they can go out there now with Ruggs and Darren Waller, like you've got a tight end that runs 4.45. You've got a wideout that's in the 4.2s, and you've got a running back who ran for over 1,100 yards. Now you're going to be able to take some shots, you know, and we'll see if Derek Carr can get in that attack mode. But that's what I – when I look at teams and I say, okay, I know what you're trying to do. I didn't love Isaiah Wilson as a player. I did not think he was a first-round player, but he fits. You know, that's what Tennessee wants to do. They want to beat people up and run the ball down your throats. Like, go get the mammoth, you know, right tackle. That's kind of what they do. So when I look at these things and try and figure out, it's not who got the best players. It's who fits with these guys. Like this, I can make sense of it. And that's why with the Packers, you know, like A.J. Dillon, that doesn't really fit like how they've played unless they're totally changing what they're doing.
So I'll throw two at you that I got from teams. One was Brandon Ayuk.
Yep.
And I know how much you love him, but yep. Brandon Ayuk going to play for Kyle Shanahan in San Francisco. And the other was Clyde Edwards-Helaire.
Oh, yeah.
Going to Kansas City. So those are the two that I got from teams that should really work. Like Ayuk, because I guess, you know, the yards after catch thing's big for Kyle. Kyle's obviously really good at evaluating receivers. And then Edwards-Helaire to Kansas City, you know, based on the circumstances.
He's going to have so much space to work underneath in the pass game. I mean, that's – you know, the crazy thing with Kansas City is you think about with Kelce and Tyreek Hill and Sammy Watkins and all the weapons down the field. But last year, seeing it up close, you know, personal two times, you know, what Mahomes can do with his legs, like anytime he wants, because they have so much speed, he can run for 10 yards anytime he wants. You know, how many third and fives have you seen him just easily go pick up 8-10 yards? And now instead of him even doing that, he can just take the lazy route and say, oh, Clyde, you got it. You got all that space. You go make something happen. I mean, it's not fair. I got a text. Actually, I should pull it up. I'll text it to you. I got a text from one of our mutual friends that's high up with one of the top teams in the league and just said, how are we supposed to cover all their eligibles? Like after the Clyde Edwards-Helaire pick, like everybody they can potentially get out into the route causes a problem.
It was funny because like at the end of the whole process too, I kind of got the feeling more and more teams started to get hot on him. And it was like you're watching Burrow or you're watching Charles or you're watching Jefferson or you're watching whoever. Mm-hmm. And like what I'd hear from these coaches and these scouts was you kept getting drawn back to 22 because he kept showing up over and over and over again. So that should be fascinating. Okay, big picture questions. The first one I have for you really – and, you know, because you still talk to all of these guys. You got so many relationships through the league in the scouting community. You know, the last 3 months were different for everybody.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you got back what I got back, which was certain things actually worked better. You know, like there were certain things that they actually that GMs, that coaches actually thought, you know what, this is actually better than it was before.
Yeah.
So I think there's going to be changes. Do you have a feel for what some of the big picture changes and how scouts do their jobs, GMs do their jobs, even coaches when they get involved, you know, in the spring, how all of this works in the future?
I think it's fascinating. And I think a lot of people have talked about the coaching side of it. And I said it on the broadcast though. I mean, I talked to a quarterback coach in the NFL who said this has been a good thing for his home life to be, you know, during this time of year in the off season, quote unquote, for coaches, to be watching tape and doing that work at home as opposed to being in the office. And he gave a great example. He's like, look, we have a couple of years. And, you know, it's not like I'm not even sitting there like, you know, I quote unquote, you know, watching the kids. But he's like, if my wife has to run to the post or to the mailbox or my wife has to go run to the grocery store real quick, like I'm home, she can go do those things. Like it's just made life so much easier on our family for me to be working, you know, from home during this period of time. And it's been healthy for them. to have that time together, which I think is great. And I think we will see a continuation of that. What I'm fascinated to see is now that we go through to the fall with scouting, because, and I've talked to a couple people about this, and they share the same belief in that, for those that don't know, as scouts, you're gone 150 to 200 nights a year. You're gone. Most guys go out 2 weeks at a time, come home for a weekend, 2 weeks at a time, come home for a weekend. And you go from school to school to school to school. Now, when you go to the school, what you need to get accomplished there is you need to, first and foremost, watch the tape, which you used to have to do. You have to go to the school to watch the tape because it was all on beta, right? So they would have to send those tapes into the NFL Dub Center. They would send them out to your teams. Your teams would then send them out to the area scouts. Well, that's long since over. Everybody has access to that on their you know, iPads, Surface devices at home. So you don't need to go in there to watch the tape. That used to be one of the reasons you go in. Second reason you go in is because you got to go talk to the source. You got to go in there. You talk to the liaison, the assistant coach, the position coach, academic advisor, trainer. Well, as teams have now gotten more comfortable dealing with Zoom and having those Zoom calls, I think what you're going to end up having is these schools telling a lot of these scouts, especially during this next year, hey, on Tuesdays and Thursdays for Oregon, you know, at 8 a.m., our strength coach is going to be on Zoom. At 8:30, it'll be our academic advisor. At 9 o'clock, it'll be – and you can talk to all those people from home. So that's a reason. Cross that one off the list of why you'd have to be there. Following – the last reason would be you want to see these guys move around, right? And most colleges, what they do is they let scouts come out for practice during, like, the pat-and-go session, you know, where quarterbacks and receivers just playing catch. Linebackers and DBs are just going through their individual drills. You don't even get to stay out on the field for any of the team interaction because these college coaches are paranoid that you're going to share some information. So why couldn't they then make that video, that portion of practice, and make that available online where you can see these guys warm up so you can body type them, see them move around? So that those are all the reasons why you would have to physically go on the campus. They're all gone. There's no reason why you couldn't do all of that from home. And at the colleges, with a virus going around, the less people they're bringing into their building, especially guys that have been hopscotching all over the country, they're not going to want those guys coming into their building. So I think we could be looking at a fall where scouts are literally doing their jobs from home.
That's, like, interesting too, because somebody brought that up to me. It's like, and I think it was a scout who actually, I think his wife might have brought it up to him. Where he was do you really think by the fall it's going to be okay for, like, somebody who's in that sort of job to be going literally from college campus to college campus, going from state to state, for some guys going to different parts of the country, right? Like your national scouts, your college scouting directors, those guys, like, are going all over the country. Like, and his point was, it's not going to be we're probably not going to be at that point in the fall. Yeah. So even if you don't want to do some of the things you're talking about, to some degree you might be forced to, right? Yeah. Like, so some teams might get a dry run at this naturally.
Absolutely. And, you know, I just think that's kind of where we're headed. And I know in the grand scheme of things, this is not a lot of money, but when you add up a scouting staff of 15 to 20 guys and you add up all the mileage that they get reimbursed for, the hotels, the meals, all that stuff, that's money that you're putting back in the pocket of the organization, not having to travel these guys all over the place. And the other thing I would say is, you know, one of the main benefits is getting to see these guys interact with their teammates and move around, which is just going to put more emphasis on, you know, potentially going to games where you could be spread out, you know, and still get a chance to see these guys at some games in your area. You know, you scout the West Coast, you live where I live, you know, Oregon's going to come play at USC. So instead of me going up to Oregon to see those guys, I'll see them at the Coliseum, you know, close by. Team area scouts can do that all over the country. And the other thing is, you'll get a chance to say, you know what, we'll see these guys at All-Star games, we'll see them at the Combine, and we'll get a chance to fill in whatever gaps we may have.
There's got to be, like, an element of, I just think about it from my own standpoint, though. Like, FaceTime is still valuable, like, for me, like, as far as source building. Like, as much as I can be talking and texting with guys, it's still valuable for me to be in front of them.
Yeah.
So that's got to exist to some degree, right? Because, well, I mean, like, a huge part of a scout's job is information gathering that's not just sitting in front of a screen and watching tape, right?
What it's going to do is it's going to create a tremendous advantage for guys that have been doing it for a while and have built up relationships. Then I can call the assistant coach that I've known for 20 years and I know I'm going to get the real story from him, even if we're not face to face. Whereas, you know, a younger guy that's starting out, you're just one of many faces on a Zoom box of scouts that he's giving the standard spiel to. You know, you're going to have that extra level of communication, which is obviously you benefit from being face to face. But I don't think that's where we're going to be in the upcoming year.
Okay. The second big picture thing, and I think that this one's really interesting. There are a bunch of guys who, and this is probably every year, but there are a handful of guys who had tough calls on whether or not to declare and chose to go back. And I'll run down, you can add to this list, the names that are just off the top of my head. There are a bunch at Bama. Mm-hmm. Alex Leatherwood, Najee Harris. We talked about Devontae Smith a little bit before, before we went on here. The corner at Ohio State, Sean Wade. Travis Etienne, I think that was a real shocker that he didn't come out. He's a junior running back at Clemson, going to be a senior in the fall. So I think the question becomes now, with we're into May, and generally guys have to declare for the supplemental draft in June. If there's still a lot of uncertainty over the college season happening in the fall, do you think there's going to be an influx of these kids trying to get into the supplemental draft? And could the supplemental draft in July look a lot different than it normally does?
I know teams are preparing for just this situation. You know, we'll have to wait and see what happens. And I have to refresh myself quite honestly on the rules of being eligible to get into the supplemental draft. But I guarantee you you can come up with a hardship when you can show that there's no certainty you're going to play your season. But you just mentioned some quality guys there, and this is a chance if you're a team to really kind of have two drafts to come back and really upgrade your roster. And I think, you know, in years past, supplemental usually maybe every 4 or 5 years we'll see a guy go in the third round, and then outside of that, you know, sixth round, seventh, guys just sign afterwards. But it has not been, you know, a big influx of talent. When you start seeing potentially some of the names that you just mentioned coming in, now you're going to have teams saying, you know, not second round picks, a couple first round picks in that list. Then it becomes really fascinating. You talk about NFL team, a chance to double down and really upgrade your roster. That could be a very, very good list. And one of the other things talking to an agent the other day who brought this up and said, you know, it's one thing for Power Five schools to not have fans in attendance and how they could proceed and it could be still financially, you know, sensible, you know, in terms of what they get from the TV contracts. But if you're a non-Power Five school and you don't have that same level of contract, they rely on the gate for a lot of their income. So how are they going to pull this up? How are they going to pull that off if they're saying you can play the games, but there's no fans? I mean, just operating the department, I don't know that they'd be right side up for some of those schools. So with that, what I'm getting at is, would that lead some of those non-Power Five players that maybe aren't, you know, maybe you're talking about fifth, sixth, seventh round type picks, would that lead them to jump into this supplemental draft? I mean, it's just, there's a lot of unknowns.
Are there a couple names that stick out that really excite you then? I'm sure maybe I mentioned a couple of them there, but like where you would say, God, you know, you at least have to have a discussion in the first round and maybe he will go in the second round.
I think that Devontae Smith would have been in the discussion to be the top receiver this year. He'd have been in that group. I think Travis Etienne had a really good chance of being the top running back in this group. So you're talking about potentially after the draft has already happened, you get like another shot at this thing to potentially get the best receiver and best running back. Like, they're still out there. I don't know that we've seen that in a long, long time.
And you know what? Another name popped in my head too, the Penn State tight end.
Yep.
Like, he's another one that
a lot of people thought would come out. Yeah.
Right. All right. Last thing for me then. I appreciate all the time, DJ.
Yep.
So, you know, I know you haven't really, really dove in yet on 2021, but you have a working knowledge of the class.
Yeah.
What do you think we're going to be talking about in 10, 11 months when it comes to the 2021 class?
Well, that's always going to be the quarterbacks. I think Trevor Lawrence has probably – I'd love to get your thoughts on this. I would say Trevor Lawrence going back to – you'd have to go back to Andrew Luck to find somebody that was, A, this kind of hyped, but, B, was like a foregone conclusion he's going to be the top quarterback. Even though, you know, Fields is an intriguing player. Kid North Dakota State's got a lot of buzz early on. But I think in terms of like a clear front runner, like Sam Darnold was a front runner, but there was, you know, it wasn't to this level of expectation with where we are with Trevor Lawrence, with his skill set, everything that he possesses. I mean, I would, that's what I would argue.
I think the difference is that there's like 2 years of runway. Like yeah. Andrew Luck, when he was a redshirt freshman, like you started to hear he's going to be the number one overall pick.
Yeah.
Then the second year, it like became a certainty. Mm-hmm. Then he didn't come out. Then he went back. And there was a third year. And so you had like this long runway.
Yeah.
It's like Peyton Manning when I was a teenager for that. So I don't like I made yeah. my recollection of that might not be. But I remember people talking about him being a really high pick early in his career. And so that's why I think that with Lawrence, it's like that. Like mm-hmm. it was very early that people identified him. That guy's going to be a high pick. Mm-hmm. So I guess Fields. Does Fields have a shot of – because I don't think he does because yeah. I just think at the end of the day, Lawrence is going to be such a safe pick for whoever. Mm-hmm. But from what you've seen of Fields, would he have a chance of overtaking him?
I mean, I think – look, I saw both these kids on the high school field together up at the opening at Nike, and Fields was the MVP of the tournament. So it was a 7-on-7 tournament up there with all the top high school players in the country. So he's – ability-wise, he's pretty special. I mean, that would not – you know, totally shocked me, I guess. I would still say that you have a commanding lead if you're Lawrence, but that feels legit. Like, this is not somebody that you're like a fringe first rounder. Does he vault way up? You know, like we've seen the last couple years with the number one overall picks. Like, he's not going to have to come from the back of the pack like Joe Burrow, Field, or Kyler Murray. Like, he's starting in a better position than those guys were that ultimately ended up being the top pick. I just don't think in these classes we've had over the last few years, we had somebody with kind of the reputation that Lawrence has.
So is there a guy like that you're kind of keeping your eye on that could be, I mean, 3 years in a row, right? Like yeah. we've had a guy who's kind of come from the back of the pack, Baker Mayfield, you know, Kyler Murray, and now Joe Burrow. Like nobody looked at those guys as first round picks, let alone number one overall picks going into their last year.
Yeah.
Is there someone you're keeping an eye on that could be that guy?
Well, I mean, I'll know more probably in the next couple weeks as I jump in on these guys and really start to see them. The kid in North Dakota State's the one that everybody's been talking about. Trey Lance, am I getting that one
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I think that's right.
Yeah, so he's one that's definitely got some attention from guys that have started to do their early work. The one I'm kind of fascinated on to study, who I have not studied yet, I know he was hurt a lot last year, but I'm good buddies with Coach Shaw up there at Stanford. He really likes Davis Mills, their quarterback. So, and I know he's had some injuries, battled some injuries, but David's seen some good ones and kind of knows what they look like, and he really likes his kids.
Okay, so is there
like, when you how he plays?
Okay, when you look at the class as a whole, then other things that you think will stick out about the class?
Well, I mean, I think Penei Sewell, when you look at the offensive line, like get a chance to have a premier offensive tackle. You know, it's not often we have a tackle that gets the type of hype that he's gotten so far. It's clearly kind of been the best tackle in college football now. So he that'll be an interesting storyline to follow. I think we're going to see another boatload of receivers. I mean, we're just kind of in that era where you expect it now. I haven't, you know, again, I haven't done the kid yet, but the kid at Minnesota, everybody raves about him to me. I have not watched him yet, so I'm anxious to study him. I know about Devontae Smith. I know about Waddle, who will be draft eligible next year, who's, you know, he's a freak show with how explosive and how fast he is. You've got Justin Ross at Clemson. I mean, there's a long –
Jamar Chase.
Jamar Chase. Is Olave draft eligible too?
I believe, Olave is
Ohio
too, yeah.
State. So, there's going to be another really good group of wideouts.
All right. He's Daniel Jeremiah. You can find him at Move the Sticks on NFL.com. His podcast, Move the Sticks, with my buddy Bucky Brooks. Anywhere else? I didn't miss anything there, DJ?
No, I think you got it, buddy. Yeah, this is fun. This is kind of the fun time of year. I don't know how you approach it, but I get a chance to try and learn and grow on your own. And then we've kind of transferred this podcast during this time of year. We did it last year. But Bucky and myself, we said, you know what, we want to talk to like team builders. So we've really just kind of had the who's who of, you know, the top college coaches. We have baseball GMs on. We're working on getting a couple basketball GMs on and just kind of learning about overall, you know, team building philosophy. So as much as I love studying the individual players, the team building stuff is kind of – it's another thing that excites me about this time of year.
That's really interesting too, because you probably – I would be interested to hear like what a baseball GM or a basketball GM thinks of like NFL GMs. You know what I mean? Like, and what he thinks they do well and what they don't do. You know what I mean? Because I'm sure that they all have, because you know those guys talk. So I wonder like what their opinions of each other are.
That's what I'm trying to find out, man. That's what we're going to do this summer.
All right. Appreciate it, DJ.
Thanks, bud.
Hey, one thing I was going to ask you, kind of like, and I was took too much of your time, but I think it's just an interesting topic. Do you go back and like look at like what maybe people might have missed on Burrow last year? Like, would you go back and like look at your notes? I'm just wondering.
I have them, yeah. I have them, yeah. I mean, I just think that I just don't think that the comfort level with him was there last year more than anything else. I mean, it's all been discussed, but. And I thought I had written about him before the year started and said I thought he had a chance to be kind of a breakout guy, but I, you know, not to this extent. But I mean, I definitely thought there was more talent there than the production indicated. There was more meat on the bone, but I did not know it was going to go to this level.
Yeah, it was interesting because I think you'll find this interesting. He said to me that like he had to remind himself that he was an athlete, right? Yeah. And what he said was, he goes, you know, when you're I was a practice quarterback for 3 years, and what they want you to do when you're a practice quarterback, throw the ball away, right? Yeah. So you keep throwing the ball away, throwing the ball away, throwing the ball away. It's like I had to remind myself that I don't, like, that's not who I am as a player.
Yeah.
And he said once I started to remind myself that halfway through my junior year, I started to play differently. I thought that was really interesting how, like, being a practice player for so long had sort of affected how he played, you know? And he was like, you know, my strength is as a competitor, and I wasn't playing like that because I've been so used to sort of competing in this sterile environment that wasn't like just, you know, don't get hit.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I thought that was really interesting.
No, I just think also just general rust. Like, yeah, played much in 3 years, man. Like, he just knocked off some of that rust. But he's easy to root for. He's a good kid. You know, the guy we forgot, by the way? We forgot Marvin Wilson. That was the guy we forgot.
That's right. Yeah. So.
But I mean, I'm telling you, like, the reason I was a little bit late because I was talking to Joe D, and we were kind of going through all the supplemental guys and talking about that. And like you're a team like that address the offensive line. Like, you might, I mean, between me, you, and the wall, but like, you could really address your skill positions, you know, and the supplemental.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, and you might be able to get a bargain on a guy because teams are hesitant to give up future picks.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? Like, it's just, it makes more sense. It makes a ton of sense. And if you're one of these kids and it's like you're sitting there in the middle of June and it's, you know, the rumor I heard was that they're looking at starting the college season October 1st now, and that they're going to eliminate the non-conference schedule.
Yeah.
Because I think for a number of reasons, but I think part of it is that they can't get kids on campus quick enough.
Yeah.
And if they do that, then like, I think some of these kids probably look at it and say, do I really want to go back for 8 games?
Yeah.
You know, and I don't know. I just think there are a lot of moving parts.
The other thing is like, just, am I going to have access to a working weight room and all that kind of stuff? Like, you don't think about that. Like, well, if the NFL is open and I'm going to get a chance to get coached, trained, and get better versus my university, who might be a little bit more liberal in their approach, saying, you know, you guys can't be on campus and all that kind of stuff. So it's fascinating.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, yeah, so I'm digging in a little more into it too, but I think it's really, really interesting.
All right, hey,
bud, I always appreciate the time. If you need anything from me,
thanks,
ever,
man.
You know to reach out.
Thanks, glad I could dress up for you. Appreciate that.
Well, I don't know. I might have done you better. My sleeves are torn. Like,
I was outside shooting jumpers, talking to Joe D, and I was like, oh crap, I gotta go to Breer.
There you go. There you
all
go.
Right.
We'll get back out there.
Later,
appreciate
bro.
It. All right, later. All right. Thanks again to DJ. He's the best. Go check out all of his stuff. You guys know where to find him on NFL.com, NFL Network, and you know he'll be getting you guys ready for the 2021 draft real soon. We're going to jump into the six-pack. You guys know how this works. Because of the pandemic, we've been in the situation pretty much all off-season where we can't do the voicemails and the emails, so we're reverting to doing the six-pack on Tuesday. Every Tuesday, I put the call out for questions on Twitter. I ask, you send me questions. Once I get them, I sort through them. If I like your question, you get an answer. Plus, you get a like on Twitter. I hit that little heart button there. Question number one, this is from Ray. It's at BlackBod Community Manager, at BB Ray. Ray 1, Chargers head coach Anthony Lynn, treading the company line with support for Tyrod, or is it genuine? Thoughts on how many games before we see Herbert? All right, so first of all, you know, having talked to Aylin about this, I don't think that Tyrod goes into camp with a job locked down. If Herbert blows them away, Herbert blows them away and he's the starter. Tyrod will get the first snap, but that does not mean that he's the starter week one. That said, I do think that they really like Tyrod. I think that they were okay going forward with Tyrod if they didn't like this year's quarterbacks. I don't think that they ever saw him as the answer for the next 5 or 6 years. I know that there's been, it's been out there that they really like him, and I don't think that's untrue. But there's different degrees of that. And so would you feel comfortable with him as your quarterback for a couple years if you needed him to be the guy because you couldn't find the right long-term answer? Yeah, I think that Anthony Lynn and Tom Telesco and all the guys in the Charger organization would be okay with that. You know, but clearly they knew that they had to find a long-term answer. And I'm told that they were comfortable with Tua Tagovailoa too. So they would have taken either Herbert or Tagovailoa with the 6th overall pick. And ultimately, you know, I think that organizationally, if Justin Herbert shows that he can come in and be at least even with what Tyrod is, then I think he starts because it's in the best long-term interest of the organization. We saw what happened in Cleveland with Tyrod. I think the situation is somewhat similar to that, except that Herbert, I think, is going to be given a real chance to compete for the job in camp, where with Baker Mayfield, it was more he won it in September. Question number two from Jasper, that's Jasper Romelet. I probably butchered your name there. How will the ongoing pandemic affect upcoming negotiations for a new television deal? Good question, Jasper. I do think that it will, but maybe not in the way that you think. I think it's more sort of based on the spending, based on the spending of big businesses in general now. And is there a cap on how much Fox can spend? And is there a cap on how much CBS can spend? These are still going to be historic television deals. But I think a lot of it is going to sort of ride on, you know, like what's happening with the larger parent companies that are making decisions for NBC Sports, for Fox Sports, for ESPN and ABC Sports. Like, who's ultimately making those decisions? It's the parent companies, and they're the ones that are going to put the cap on how much you can spend. And so I still think it's an incredibly valuable product. I think that you will see like a very, very spirited bidding process. And I think that, you know, if we get to the fall and this is still going on and football is on TV, we'll see how much football is really valued in this country, which I believe it's a lot. And so, you know, I think all of those things come into play, but I think the just the way big business operates is going to be a factor in all of this too. Question number three is from 385 career home runs at HOF Dewey. I think that's Dwight Evans, right? What do you think the 2021 salary cap will look like? We mentioned this off the top. I think that it really sort of depends on what form the 2020 season is played in. If it's played in front of fans, if it's played in the form of a full 16-game season, then it will be unaffected. And, you know, maybe future salary caps are affected by how the television deals work out, but it will be unaffected. If it's a shortened season, or if it's a, or if we have a situation where home games are not attended by fans, then I think the best that the players can hope for is that it's flat in 2021, which means it's right under $200 million again. And that's a blow for the players because they were expecting this whole thing to sort of spike. Now, that said, it's good that they got the CBA done because, man, it would have been very, very difficult to negotiate a new collective bargaining agreement in this environment. Question number four from Don Ridenour, one of our regulars. How many games do you think get played this year? I'm sorry, I'm not going to answer that question. Don, I'm going to come back to you in the mailbag, okay? Question number four, this is from Travis PPH, that's at Salvajay 50. Do you think Andrew Thomas was the best offensive tackle in this year's draft? It's a good question, Travis. I think he was the cleanest offensive tackle in this year's draft. I think if I was the Giants and it was my first pick with Joe Judge as the head coach, Andrew Thomas would have been the player I was most comfortable taking. And so I 100% endorse their decision to pick him. He may not have had the highest upside of the four, but I think it was the right move. And here's why. As I made my phone calls ahead of the draft, you really heard the other three guys get picked apart. I think that to some degree, the Alabama coaches were a little lukewarm on Jedrick Wills. So I think that that is something that came into play for some teams that are closer to some of those Alabama coaches. There's also the question, can he play left tackle? Obviously, he was a right tackle as a collegian. You know, with Tristan Wirfs, is he a left tackle? Is he a right tackle? Is he a guard? With Mekhi Becton, there's the weight issue. There's a discipline issue. There's a consistency issue. But he's got enormous upside. Andrew Thomas was the one that you couldn't really pick apart. And so, you know, in the days leading up to the draft, I remember asking around just like, hey, like, why isn't this guy going higher? Like, why do people look at him and say like 9th, 10th, 11th pick, shouldn't he be the first one to go? And so I think there was some pretty simple logic there. And you add that to the fact that he played for Kirby Smart at Georgia and Smart was on the staff with Joe Judge at Alabama. It makes all the sense in the world that the Giants took Andrew Thomas 4th overall. Question number 6. I think this is 6, right? No, this is question number 6. Okay, we are going to get to your question, Don. Question number 5, sorry. Long week. This is from Paul Mon. That's at Morney 7. Is Gase on any kind of hot seat for the upcoming season, or will any blame for a poor year be pointed at Darnold? I think Gase is fighting for his job in 2020 for a very specific reason. And that very specific reason has nothing to do with Sam Darnold. It doesn't even really have as much to do with the GM, with Joe Douglas. It has to do with ownership. And, you know, the question is Woody Johnson coming back in the summer from the UK? If Woody Johnson's coming back from the summer in the UK, he didn't hire Adam Gase. And so I think immediately the Adam Gase is sort of put on notice at that point. And at that point, Adam Gase, through no fault of his own, is going to be watched because the guy making the decision didn't hire him. And I think that creates a different dynamic for anybody. So absolutely, yes, I think he is on to some degree a hot seat and will blame you for a poor year be pointed at Darnold. No, I mean, I think he's going to have to be fully accountable for whatever happens this year, including what happens with Darnold, because the reason he was brought in is because he's got a reputation for developing young quarterbacks. Finally, question number 6. Don, I'm going to circle back to you. This has been a little bit of a 10-car pileup here getting to your question, but this is question number 6 from Don Ridenour, at Don Ridenour. How many games do you think get played this year, and when does the season start? I'm going to say 16, and I think the season starts on time, whatever the date for kickoff is, September 10th. I'm not 100% on that. I don't know for sure, but I'm going to say it does start on time. I would not rule out if it makes a difference as far as putting butts in the seats, having fans in the stands. I would not rule out the idea that they move it back a month to October 1st. I think that certainly is in play at the college level as well. Thank you guys for coming out. I appreciate you guys sticking with me as the weather gets nice and we're all still cooped up, and it's actually May now and things are a little slower in the NFL. We're going to try to do some, let's just say this, we're going to try some different stuff with the podcast over the next couple of months. I may add, a different form of podcast too, but I want your feedback on what you guys want here too. And you guys know how to get to me on all my social channels, at Albert Breer on Twitter, at Albert R. Breer on Facebook, at Albert_Breer on Instagram. And you guys know where to find this podcast. And if you don't, then you just bumped into us, but you can get us in the MMQB NFL podcast feed. There you can also get the Monday morning podcast with Gary. You can get the Weekside podcast with Jenny and Connor. You can get our gambling podcast, which I think returned last week. You can get all of us under one feed. That's the MMQB NFL podcast feed. There's also the MMQB NFL news feed, which gives you the news in a bite-sized form. Both those podcast feeds, click on both of them. You can find those on Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, Google Play, Apple Podcasts, wherever you guys get your shows. Same time next week. I'll see you then.